Fighting continues, raging on in the eastern Donbass region, with Russian forces assaulting a Ukrainian holdout in Severodonetsk.
For the moment, Severodonetsk is kind of what Mariupol was, because Mariupol was basically holding the main forces of Russian Federation.
Plus, what's needed to address the mental health of those affected by the trauma of war?
Because the need of more mental health is needed. So yes, there is help, very nice help, very good people, a lot of Ukrainian psychologists, very well trying to help, but it's not enough.
And later in the program, the UN warns that global hunger is likely to rise. Today is Monday, June 13th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Sunday that Russian casualties may surpass 40,000 in June. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma starts us off.
Speaking to the nation in his 109th daily address since the start of the Russian invasion, Zelensky again calls for advanced air defense systems from the West. He claims such defenses would have averted many tragedies, including an airstrike on Sunday, which injured 10 people, including a 12-year-old girl. Zelensky says people are still in hospitals. This strike had no tactical or strategic sense, just as the vast majority of other Russian strikes. This is terror, just terror, he says. The 12-year-old girl was from Kharkiv, escaping from the Russian army. As for the near 40,000 troops lost, Zelensky says in no other war in many decades has Russia lost so much. I'm Charles Deledesma.
Russian forces continue their assault on the eastern city of Severodonetsk, and earlier I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv about the continued fighting in Ukraine's Donbas.
We should remember that, as you correctly said, Donbas area, so I take the whole Donbas with Donetsk and Luhansk regions, both of them, these are areas which are in war from the very beginning, from 2014. And of course, the most equipped and the most trained forces are there, and they have been there for a very long time. And from the very beginning of the full-scale war, the most professional, let's put it this way, forces and experienced forces are there, because from the very beginning, that area was one of the main from which the assault was expected.
Like you said, the fighting in this region has been going on since 2014, right? So taking a look at Ukraine, what does it see as its most key objectives?
So for Ukraine, the most important is to keep alive the servicemen and the forces of which are now located in Severodonetsk and in Donbas region in general, because these are the most trained and experienced forces. This is very important to remember and to understand. For the moment, Severodonetsk is kind of what Mariupol was, because Mariupol was basically holding the main forces of Russian Federation. And now Severodonetsk is doing the same and making the same effort. Also, Ukrainian forces there, as longer they keep these forces of the Russian Federation there, more time Ukraine has in other locations and other directions of fighting.
So it sounds that if Severodonetsk were to fall, it would free up Russian forces to attack elsewhere.
President Zelensky have highlighted that basically the battle for Donbas would play a very huge role. If we analyze the situation that Ukrainians have to leave Severodonetsk, it's very important that they are not surrounding, but they are leaving tactically. So they leave with their equipment and they just change the positions, basically.
And in the time that we have left, I really wanted to quickly cover this. President Zelensky also made renewed calls for heavy weapons.
Ukrainian president is encouraging partners to, continue and the pass and not to slow down. This is very important. A lot of equipment is already in place and Ukrainians are training already with this equipment because they need certain time to get trained. What we hear from the general staff is that it would take a couple of more weeks for Ukrainians to train. So we expect that all this equipment would be in action in the mid-July, something like that.
And we have additional updates on our website, voanews.com/flashpoint. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
More than 100 days since Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine, the war's toll on the country's population continues to be assessed and addressed. Previously on this program, we've spoken with healthcare professionals working directly with refugees in Poland and others that are assisting children. And since mid-April, Doctors Without Borders mental health care teams have carried out more than 1,000 sessions and continue to see the widespread need for further care as the war continues. Lena Vija is the group's mental health activity manager who's in Ukraine right now. And while the phone lines to her location weren't the best, I did begin our conversation by asking her to describe what the MSF teams were seeing on the ground.
The symptoms have been changing a little bit depending on the zone we are. So, for example, in the place I am, in Pro and Zaporizhia, we are having the possibility to provide attention to persons just arriving from the territories that are under shelling or that are under a lot of violence, places like Mariupol and other places that are also like occupied territories. So these persons came from a very acute war situation. And when they come, they are in survival mode. That means their main concern is to find their basic needs. They need to find a shelter. They need to find food for their children or for themselves. They are just being conscious about their loss and the impact of the war in their life.
So, Lena, when they get to a safer location, like where you are, what happens?
They begin to really understand what is going on. So we have seen persons very sad, of course, with a lot of symptoms related with anxiety. That means stress, worriness, thinking all the time, with a lot of difficulties to sleep, with problems with food, very worried about the future. Some of them have more symptoms related to depression, very sad, losing time of hope because they see that the time is passing and anything is changing. So in this part of our intervention, they are just understanding what is going on. But in other places where they have already stabilized a little bit and they have been safe for a while, most complex symptoms are appearing. Of course, it depends on the age of the person.
Speaking of age of the person, so much has been reported on the plight of refugees since the war began. But I wanted to ask you, you know, we're talking about mental health. How are children dealing with it?
Children basically feel very worried to be alone, are having issues to adapt. You know, they lost their school, their classmates, their pets. So this is very difficult for a child. And they have to behave like little adults. So their childhood stuck. And in childhood and in adolescence is where we build our personality. So that could have also like very extreme consequences in the persons, in the children now, in the adults of the future.
People just arriving from conflict zones need to have that sense of security, that foundational need, so they can start the healing process. And I guess I wanted to ask you is what kind of challenges are you facing there in Zaporizhia and other places similar to that with people just coming in who are really fresh from the conflict and getting them the help that they need so that they can, you know, meet that foundational need. So as time passes and they are in that safer location, can, you know, begin the healing process?
Yeah, we have like the idea is not to pressure. The idea is to respect the moment of the person. So if the person is having a crisis, like a very acute emotional situation, we provide a safe space. We allow them to express all these emotions they have been containing. We provide kind of explanation. We call it psychoeducation about them to understand what is going on with them. they feel like a relief when they understand that all these feelings, all these emotions that are just suddenly coming up are normal and expected to a kind of situation like this. And the main goal of our approach is to help them to feel they have some kind of control in their lives and in their situations against the difficulty of the same situation. So to allow them to recognize their own resources, to link them with the providers of the services they are needed, in that just linking, just giving them the chance to gain some kind of control, and we are supporting them to face like the moment and to make that this grief and this worryness and this scare don't become higher.
Can that be done where you are, or do you need to address some basic levels of foundational care immediately and then transit them to perhaps a safer location?
That's a good question. We try to be in this reception center. So these are like the first contact or the first places when they arrive for the most difficult zones. And when we met them, we, of course, get the contact and we try to follow them to the shelters. They usually are located in shelters. But there are like different possibilities. Some of them just want to stay in those shelters. So for us, it's easier if the shelters are in the same city and in Sapporo or Nitro that we have teams. We can go to the shelters and follow up and continue this care. But when their expectation is to move across the country or to go to other countries, it's quite more difficult. So we try to have like a kind of follow-up by phone, like teleconsulting. But yes, most of the persons we have the chance to meet, usually we met them for once. We call it like we have the possibility to do in just one session as much as we can. And we focus on providing this safe place, allowing this expression of emotions and trying this person like regain control on the situation. Unfortunately, that is absolutely challenging. We try as much as possible with the resources we have to do this follow-up or to refer and to follow up these referrals with our colleagues that are known, but sometimes it's very difficult and we just have one chance to support.
Speaking of support, Doctors Without Borders is not the only organization providing mental health care to those who are not only internally displaced, but have become refugees and have left Ukraine. Is there enough help available to address the needs of these millions of individuals who are escaping the fighting?
The need or the habit to go to psychologists is not very high. They have the chance to go to psychiatrists. They have a very good system to have access to psychiatrists, but in those severe conditions. But psychologists is not really a service that is very much looked for. But because from 2014, there has been this need, there has been also like a very big interest in the country and of a lot of professionals to become psychologists and to become persons with some kind of expertise or a lot of expertise in trauma and crisis. So there are these associations of psychologists who decided to stay, who are in their countries, volunteering some of them, or being hired by organizations like us that wants to help. So yes, there are persons, there are other organizations, there are these associations that I found wonderful because they know the culture, are part of the community, they know the language, but that is a huge barrier for us, the ones who don't speak the language. So, for example, I am not the one providing usually care. I have a team of psychologists who are from him and psychologists who have been in this kind of associations trying to improve and really having very good skills in trauma. However, we are doing like a call to the world to provide, because the need of more mental health is needed. So, yes, there is help, very nice help, very good people, a lot of Ukrainian psychologists, very well trained, trying to help. But it's not enough. And it's not enough because we are in a moment that the crisis is still very acute. But when it stops, when they can face the reality of what they lost, and when they have to face that they have to rebuild their life, that would be a very difficult moment and that will need a lot of support.
So in your opinion, what needs to happen? Because as you mentioned, it's not enough now. Where do things need to be so that it is enough?
Yeah, so what we need to do now and what is the focus now is to do a lot of awareness. That means to talk about the people, to tell them, okay, this can be happening to you. You might be feeling this. This is normal. This happened, but it's important you to face it and you to live it. You cannot just delay pain. You cannot delay sadness or anger. You have to face it, and the ideal is to face it in a safe place when there's a person or there's some person that can help you to cope with it and to find your own resources to heal it. Because doing this, we are going to prevent you to face more difficult conditions. So we are in that moment of doing awareness, doing like psychoeducation, providing safe spaces, providing these moments of expressing emotions. So that's what we can do now to prevent most difficult future in terms of mental health.
Lina Vija is a health activity manager for Doctors Without Borders in Ukraine, and she was speaking to us over the phone. Lina, thank you very much.
No, thank you very much.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. On Friday, U.S. officials said that they're working with Ukraine to export at least 3 million tons of grain to combat the world's growing hunger crisis, especially in Africa. Now, before Russia's latest invasion, Ukraine was exporting some 6 million tons of grain each month. But Russia's Black Sea naval blockade means that grain that could feed 400 million people is stuck in Ukraine. Mohammed Youssef has more.
Ukraine is stuck with millions of tons of grains in the country, unable to export to the rest of the world, which is facing food shortages and high food prices due to Russia's invasion of the country. Jim O'Brien is the head of the State Department's Office of Sanctions Coordination. He says there's enough food to feed millions, but Russia's invasion makes it difficult to get it out of the country.
So there are 20 million tons of grain sitting in Ukraine right now, waiting to get out. And again, in a normal year, all that would already be on the market. And it's not. And there's one reason. Now, there are many reasons that there's a global, food security is weakened. But it's 20 million tons, which could feed 200 to 400 million people. That's just waiting on Russia's decision.
Russia and Ukraine are the grain basket of the world, and the two countries export a quarter of the world's grains. Experts say grain shortages in other countries dependent on Ukraine grains are creating high food prices and supply chain problems. On Thursday, Senegalese President and African Union Chairperson Macky Sall urged Ukraine to demand the Odesa support to help with grain exports. Speaking with French media, France 24 and RFI, Sall said if Africa does not get wheat from Ukraine, the continent will be in a famine that can create instability. O'Brien says Russia is reducing Ukraine's ability to produce its own food and food for the world.
Ukraine used to export 6 million or so tons of grain a month, mostly to the global south. And now that has had to stop. In March and April, it was very small. With our European partners, we're working very hard to get out as much grain as possible. But at best, it will probably be about half what was before. And that's because Russia has occupied or destroyed 30-odd percent of Ukraine's grain-producing capability. It is attacking grain storage and processing facilities.
The rise in food and fuel prices and a drought, which has not been seen in East Africa in 40 years, is making some 20 million people hungry. West Africa and the Sahel region are also affected because the countries rely on wheat imports from the two countries. U.S. Special Envoy for Global Food Security, Kari Fowler, says his country is supporting African countries to reduce hunger.
So we've made great efforts to try to, in an emergency situation, to provide more humanitarian assistance. But we've also announced somewhat longer term measures. I mentioned earlier that one of our flagship programs at the U.S. Agency for International Development is our Feed the Future program. That involves quite a few countries around the world, but really focuses on, in a very intense way, on about a dozen countries, I believe eight of which are in Africa. We expect that program to be expanded.
The U.S. accuses Russia of stealing Ukraine's food and selling it to friendly countries. Samuel Nyandemo teaches economics at the University of Nairobi. He says Africa will refuse to buy stolen grain from Russia, but will look for other markets to meet the demand for food.
I don't think whether there will be an African country willing to buy stolen grain from Ukraine sold by Russia.
They'll look for better alternatives, particularly from Argentina and other Latin American countries, which are also very good in terms of producing those grains. The best solution here is that Russia should come on the table with Ukraine and they sort of this thing diplomatically.
U.S. officials say they are working with Ukraine's neighbors and the European Union to get as much grain out of the country as possible and support the initiative to lift the blockade on the Odessa port. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Speaking to Reuters News, Ukraine's deputy foreign minister said on Sunday that it's established two routes through Poland and Romania to export grain and avert a global food crisis, although he has acknowledged that bottlenecks in the route have slowed the supply chain. Ukraine also says it's in talks with Baltic states to add a third corridor for the food exports. Details are unavailable as to how much grain has already moved or would possibly be moved through these routes. Meanwhile, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization warns global hunger is likely to increase because of the soaring food prices, due in part largely to the uncertainties created by the war in Ukraine. Lisa Schlein has that story.
The Food and Agriculture Organization's latest Food Outlook report forecasts international food prices will hit record highs this year, lifting global import payments to more than $1.8 trillion. The FAO says economically vulnerable people in the least developed countries in sub-Saharan Africa and net importing developing countries will suffer most from food insecurity due to rising costs. The director of the FAO's Markets and Trade Division, Boubacar Ben Belhassan, says the tightening of markets is expected to persist for all commodities this year. He attributes that to steep price hikes, the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events, market uncertainties due to the war in Ukraine, and sudden trade policy changes.
This year's food security crisis is about access. Next year, because of the expected or the lack of availability and the higher costs of inputs, in particular for fertilizer and fuel, the concern could be about lack of availability, in other words, lack of food.
The FAO reports enough food is available to feed the hungry this year, but it is not getting to the people who need it. Ben Belhassan says both Ukraine and Russia are major producers of commodities such as wheat, maize, and sunflower oil. But the war in Ukraine, he notes, is preventing those commodities from being exported to countries in greatest need.
From our estimation, we see that depending on how much this shock leads in terms of deficit or gap or reduction in the export availability for those food commodities from both Ukraine and Russia, it could lead in anywhere between 11 to 19 million more hungry people, but that's chronic hunger for 2022-2023.
The World Food Program warns of an impending catastrophe and mass starvation if Russia does not end its blockade of Ukraine's Black Sea ports. The United Nations currently is trying to find a so-called package deal to allow Ukrainian-produced food to be safely and securely exported through the Black Sea. The deal also would allow for unimpeded access to global markets for Russian food and fertilizers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.